I'm Safraz Manzoor, and for the BBC World Service, I've come here to discover the fascinating story of Bombay Jazz.
Okay, so just tell me your name.
Vince Costa.
So Vince, where are we?
We're in Banjum, standing outside club Vasco da Gama.
What's going on in here tonight?
There's a tribute to the legendary jazz musician of Goan origin, Mickey Correa, who played in Bombay for over 30, 40 years of his life.
And died recently?
Died recently, yeah, 2011.
Let's go in.
It's a hot Saturday night in Goa, and inside the club Vasco da Gama, a music legend is being honoured.
He entertained people at the Taj with swing music, jazz music of those days.
His name isn't familiar outside India, but Mickey Correa was a towering character in the story of Indian jazz. It's a story that's largely forgotten, but between the 1930s and 1960s, jazz was huge in India. Some of the greatest names in American jazz, everyone from Duke Ellington to Louis Armstrong to Dave Brubeck, came to India to perform alongside homegrown jazz heroes such as Mickey Correa and Chick Chocolate.
Jazz was a truly universal music. Everybody's forgotten that jazz had a long life in Bombay, a long, unique, fascinating life.
Naresh Fernandez is a former editor of Time Out Mumbai and the author of The Taj Mahal Foxtrot. Discovering that tracks such as this one by jazz trumpeter Chick Chocolate were produced and performed here in India from as early as the 1930s was a remarkable discovery for Fernandez, and one he made by accident.
I sort of stumbled upon it about 10 years ago. I had always gone to jazz concerts when I was in college and thought nothing of it. But a few years ago, I began to research a piece on Goan pop music, which emerged in the 60s, and it was full of funky brass and fat bass lines. And I began to talk to people about how that sound came about. And they told me that they had actually cut their teeth playing jazz, and that in the 1930s, these African-American musicians had wandered by and taught them how to play the music.
Do you have a personal interest in why the story of Bombay Jazz consumed you so much?
Well, the story of Bombay Jazz I found fascinating because it reinforced or reiterated to me how long Bombay has been a global city. It was a port city and people settled here from across the world, but how Bombay expressed the very Indian ability to take diverse influences from around the world and make them something specific. This was an expression of Bombay, of Bombay's multiculturalism, but of Bombay's great genius for adapting and expressing a sense of itself. And I thought jazz did that in the 1930s in a really coherent, appealing, entertaining way.
Jazz was still going strong a decade later. Indeed, on the night of Indian independence in August 1947, the ballroom of the Taj Hotel was filled with the sound of jazz.
They used to have the tango and the waltz and the foxtrot. All the different numbers were very popular.
Mickey Correa's wife, Doreen, is one of the few still around who can recall that incredible night.
The gate of freedom is open in India. In Karachi, capital of the newly created...
Everybody was celebrating, you know, it was quite an occasion. The gateway was close to the Taj, the gateway of India. And I think we were among all those crowds milling around over there.
That must have been amazing.
It was.
Being married to someone who is, you know, a jazz musician, did the music come first?
For him, of course. He was very particular about rehearsals, very particular. He used to get those big LPs, play each one till he had each instrument's part and work at it till he had the whole arrangement so that he had the arrangement before anybody else did. But he worked very hard to do that.
What's your most defining or memorable image of him on stage?
It's him with his hair slicked back, and he always wore shark skin on stage. He was always very particular about his appearance. The mistake we made was not to record. We were not conscious of it, you know, because I have nothing.
So there are very few actual recordings
of Mickey's now.
But you have your memories.
Yes, I was just about to say you have your memories.
One of the great tragedies of this story is that only a handful of recordings from those days have survived, and there aren't any remaining interviews with these Indian legends. I would have loved to have heard what they had to say about that golden age. It's left to others to paint a picture of what life was like in Bombay at the height of the jazz boom.
So the neighbourhood in which we sit in Bandra has always been a predominantly Roman Catholic neighbourhood. And Roman Catholics have always, because of church, had an affinity for Western music. We played Western instruments for a really long time. And so when jazz became the world's pop, this neighborhood really took to jazz quite enthusiastically. And then there were all sorts of jazz bands that popped up around us. Some of the big Indian names early in the jazz scene, there was a guy called, well, he was born Antonio Xavier Vaz, but he took the stage name of Chick Chocolate. He lived in Bandra. Another noted musician of the time was a guy called Frank Fernand, who also lived in the neighborhood. Frank Fernand's story I always find quite inspiring, because he heard Gandhi speak at a discourse in the mid-1940s and decided that he wanted to find an Indian way to play jazz. And so long before people like Coltrane and these other guys who were credited with having introduced Indian elements into jazz were trying to do this, Indians were trying to find an Indian way to play jazz. Since the 1940s, jazz had come to be an important part of Hindi film music, which is India's pop. It's the music that millions of Indians listen to. So Indians knew this music, all Indians, not just elite Indians, listening to jazz in the ballroom of the Taj and other luxury hotels. But Indians knew these rhythms because they had made their way into Hindi film.
My name is Anthony Gonsalves.
What's that?
Right. My name is Anthony Gonsalves.
Anthony Gonsalves is a name that most Indians know. There's an iconic film called Amar Akbar Anthony, and it features a song, and Amitabh Bachchan leaps out of a giant Easter egg and announces to everybody, my name is Anthony Gonsalves. The real Anthony was actually a violin player and a great arranger of Hindi film music. And he didn't really play jazz, unlike many of his Goan contemporaries, but he wanted to find a way to play Indian rags in a symphonic way.
In the 1920s, Anthony's father, Jose, was a choir director, gifted instrumentalist, and teacher working in Goa, who influenced many musicians and performers.
My name is Ronnie Francis Montserrat. My dad is Peter Montserrat.
Peter Montserrat, an established trumpeter in India during the 40s and 50s, was one of those who benefited from Jose Gonsalves' teachings. This musical education was passed on to his seven sons, who formed the Montserrat Brothers, a popular Indian jazz group who performed together for several decades. Ronnie has never forgotten the guidance that his father received.
The teaching started in the church, where they started learning Do Re Mi system, Do Re Mi Fa Sol La Si Do. They learned from there, where you have like an English system, C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C, but we had Do Re Mi system, it's international. So the grounding started with their learning to sing manuscript music just by solfa system. And then after that, he started teaching them trumpet, violin. A lot of students started learning from Anthony's father.
How big was your dad?
See, my dad was rated as the heavyweight of India then. He was a very good soloist and he was a lead trumpeter. Now, there's a difference between a soloist and a lead trumpeter. Even in today's big bands, you'll find the lead trumpeter, he's really like rock solid, you know, to lead the whole section of five trumpets, six trumpets, you know. The lead trumpeter carries the whole load, how to take over the brass section. So my dad was that kind of a musician to carry.
How did he first discover jazz?
The culture in Goa was very westernized. So they just like, you know, that culture that happened, that they used to listen to all like Duke Ellington, big bands, Count Basies. And that was the grounding that they started liking that kind of music, and most of them are all self-taught musicians.
And so they basically listened to American jazz greats,
American jazz, definitely.
And they got their vinyl records, and then they thought, we're going to try and play like
this. Yeah, imitate them, like, yeah.
And did they ever get to see, because people like Duke Ellington then arrived and played in India, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right.
Did they get to see them?
Yeah, they interacted with them. Initially, they started playing with the foreign bands, you know, like, I mean, foreigners coming in. One of them would have got a chance to play with this foreign international musician, and they would interact with them. And like my dad played with quite a lot of foreign artists that came down over here. And the beauty was that these foreigners, you know, accepted our musicians. Like, and I mean, that we could adapt to their style and the feel, you know, because jazz is something that you have to have the swing in you. You ain't got the swing, you know, you cannot just play jazz. I mean, that is, you don't play swing music. Like today's avant-garde music and all, it's okay, it's all free form. But to play swing music, you have to have that in you to swing.
Jazz also came to India partly thanks to the Cold War. Both the United States and the Soviet Union were intent on wooing India, so both nations dispatched their biggest guns. The Soviets sent the Kirov Ballet, and the Americans sent their greatest jazz stars.
So the first sort of major jazz greats to come to India in the 1950s as a result of these Cold War tours that the CIA had something to do with organizing was Dave Brubeck. And sort of this was a slightly more relaxed time. These were not one-night sort of gigs. And so musicians of the time remember these guys ambling through town, talking to them, explaining little musical concepts and sophisticated musical concepts, but really having conversations. And I think that's what's really changed in our time, where people jet in and jet out, and these are really fleeting encounters. But those were sort of by way of being genuine dialogues. And so Brubeck, for instance, jammed with a lot of Indian, with Hindustani classical musicians. After Dave Brubeck went away, Red Nichols came by, a Dixieland player whose fortunes had been revived because of a biopic that was loosely based on his life called The Five Pennies. And then he was followed by the biggest name in all of jazz, Duke Ellington, who again was on a tour through Asia that was organized by the State Department to win the hearts and minds of the colored peoples of the world, who perhaps could just become sympathizers of the Soviet Union. Again, Ellington's musicians are well loved because everybody remembers them walking through Bombay's jazz clubs, jamming with local musicians.
Visits of Brubeck, Nichols and Ellington, and later in the 60s, John Coltrane, Charlie Bird Parker and Louis Armstrong, heavily influenced India's jazz education and development. It was part of a cultural exchange that began back in the mid-30s when the Taj Hotel in Bombay had hired Leon Abbey.
Leon Abbey was a violinist from Minnesota who'd made his reputation playing in Paris, and he was hired for the 1935 season. These were six-month seasons that these guys played at that time. And he brought to Bombay, to use the very racist phraseology of that time, the first all-Negro band ever to play in India. And so Leon Abbey, if we want to date it neatly, like I said, was the first band to play jazz in India the way Americans knew jazz. Of course, India had been listening to jazz for maybe a decade before that. There were mixed racial bands that played this stuff, but there were also Indian bands that were playing this stuff, and they learned how to play the music by reading scores and by listening to the records. But having Leon Abbey in town, musicians said, was like having a masterclass in your living room.
I'm standing outside the Taj Hotel. In the 1930s, this place was the cradle of Indian jazz. As a luxury hotel, it mirrored what was going on outside in the world. Its menus presented the latest culinary trends, and its entertainment reflected the popular music of the day. Shortly after Lee and Abby's arrival, swing would find its way to the streets, and the optimism of jazz echoed the hopes of newly independent India. A lively collection of virtuosos and eccentrics, including the hefty American pianist Teddy Weatherford, the Goan trumpet player Frank Fernand, and the Anglo-Indian bandleader Ken Mack, Mickey Corea, plus many others, all helped find jazz get a home. Chick Chocolate took his inspiration from Louis Armstrong. One of Chick's daughters, Ursula Gonzalez, is herself a singer living in Mumbai with her husband and pianist, Johnny Fernandez. Both are involved with India's jazz scene, and although not as active, they still teach, perform, and enjoy a jam session in their front room.
Which wits me, over his shoulder he digs me, up Kevin, that saddened dog. I heard jazz at home. My father used to bring the records. The era of Ella, Sarah Vaughan, Anita O'Day.
Jazz meant everything to me. Every minute, even today, I would sing one phrase in my mind and try to improvise and try to incorporate that thing in my playing.
I'll give it a try, but you ain't find no guy catching. When we got married, we formed our own quartet, Johnny Fernandez Quartet, and we sang at all these places. No, I'm doing my rumba with Uno and that.
And did you ever see some of the American musicians who came over, and did you play with them at all?
Yeah, I played with Charlie Bird, I played with Kenny Barron, I played with Sadar Watanabe. I played for Herbie Hancock.
Now, you mentioned your dad. Your dad was?
Chick Chocolate.
Now, he was one of the biggest names in the Bombay jazz scene, wasn't he?
People used to call him like Louis Armstrong of Bombay. He not only did so much for jazz, but also was so outstanding in the film industry, introducing Western music to the Indian film directors. And he was an arranger.
But he was a real personality.
Yeah.
He was a bit of a showman.
Showman.
Yes. Yeah.
Absolutely. Sure.
And was he very good at interacting with the audience?
Yeah, too much.
The regulars used to come. He used to play their song for them. As soon as he entered, he knew their song. He was a good dad. He didn't make anything less for us. And we loved him.
Look at old photographs of Chick Chocolate, and you can see an uncanny resemblance to Louis Armstrong. He used the trademark handkerchief and even sang with a Louis gruff voice. But Chick was more than an imitator. Along with the trumpet, he played the violin, saxophone, piano and rhythm instruments with equal virtuosity. As arranger and conductor, he contributed to the music scores of several successful Indian films. Chick's other daughter, Yvonne, lives in Goa. She's also a singer and married to Braz Gonzalez, one of the most influential figures in Indian jazz. They're custodians of Chick's much-treasured trumpet, one which he played since the age of 25.
My brother had this, actually.
Right.
But he kept it with me because he was going to Bombay, and it was checked by a guy, Bob Tinker. He comes to Goa every year, his trumpeter. He has a jazz club in Paris. Wow. Le Revien. And he checked it and he blew it. It plays perfect. Only there's a valve somewhere that's loose or something, but it does play.
So this must mean so much to you.
Of course it does.
So when you're holding it now in your hands, and you're thinking that your dad played this at the Tard, and he played with Louis Armstrong, and he was playing, what does that make you feel?
Oh, really, I really wish he was here right now. My dad's my dad. Oof. Nothing like him.
But it must feel like he's quite close to you when you hold this.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I wish I could blow, but I'll try. Let's see. I don't know if I'll just be able to blow, okay? Not any tune or whatever. I don't know how you hold this part, Brass.
I think there's an elephant outside. So that wasn't how your dad played it?
No, not at all. Oh, I'll be degrading him.
And jazz seems to be very much a family affair. As in, it seems like a lot of the children of those jazz greats have become musicians or have married musicians as well. And that's the truth with you, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's right, yeah. I married. My father was very fond of brass.
My name is Brass Gonsalves. In the beginning, I was playing very good Dixieland clarinet. And then I heard Paul Desmond and all these people. And I started, when I was in Calcutta, that's the time I started playing real jazz. I studied properly jazz to play with one pianist. And I studied my all the charts, the chords, and you know, how to improvise on those changes. And I used to practice alone. Play alone and different style like Paul Desmond, Cannonball Adderley, those were the things. You know, like I started playing, I was getting that style.
Were you the first person to play bebop in India?
You were the first, yes.
Play something.
Alto sax is there, I think, yeah.
Brass Gonsalves' sax echoes a lifetime of musical memories, notes that have travelled the world, creating India's very own jazz legends and providing Bombay another layer to its multicultural history. As musical tastes changed in the 60s, not only in India but globally, jazz lost its popularity.
I think that the high point really came at this moment, sort of in the 60s, in the early 60s. And like so many things, the high point came exactly at the moment it was dying. There was a critical mass of musicians playing this music. They were adventurous. They had been playing this music by the mid-60s for two generations. And they played jazz with confidence and with verve. And then, of course, rock and roll came to town and tastes changed. And these guys sort of had to find new things to do, new kinds of music to play.
Today, the music continues to be presented, but to smaller audiences. And Colin De Cruz, a musician and music promoter from Goa, is producing new sounds and preserving those bygone days. He sells jazz all over the world and believes India has a new jazz capital.
Right now, Goa is the hub. Because the jazz scene and performance-wise, the amount of live venues in India, the most are in Goa, you know. At any point during the season, that's between October and March, you'll find more than 3,000 live music venues, which is, I don't think, there are very, very few cities that can boast around the world, you know, so many venues having live music.
How significant were people like Chick Chocolate and Mickey Corea in the story of Indian jazz?
Yeah, they were the actual icons, and you could call them the legends, Indian jazz legends, you know. And there was always a parallel jazz scene in India. Whatever was happening in America or in the West was also happening in India in a smaller way. If there were big bands in America, there were big bands out here. You know, if there were mainstream straight-ahead jazz bands there, there were straight-ahead jazz bands here. So there was always a parallel jazz evolution in India. In fact, I always say jazz has its roots in India because Indian classical music is all about improvisation. And that is exactly what jazz is all about, you know. So America actually just coined the word for a form of music that was already existing in India.
So in a way, what you're arguing is jazz is really Indian.
Yes, I wouldn't say jazz. I would say improvised music is really Indian.
And the Americans just came up with a word called jazz.
They penned it. They came up with a word for improvised music, and they called it jazz.
As I leave the club Vasco da Gama, I'm struck by the fact that Mickey Corea is largely forgotten outside India, and the story of Indian jazz is not much known. Which is sad, but I'm glad that modern music lovers like Naresh Fernandez are trying to keep that story from being forgotten.
If we were to wander through, you know, one of the busy streets of Bandra now, the story that you're telling me, would people be familiar with it?
Oh, not really. For them, jazz is the brand name of a car. And it's a thing that's gone. But then minstrelsy music and opera are also things that have gone. And so I don't think one needs to be nostalgic or sentimental about it. It's a fascinating story of cultural interchange. But it's a thing that happened. And now kids, I think, are finding new things to do. social dynamics have changed. They're now part of a globalized world. Maybe they're not telling specifically Indian stories the way jazz did, but that's something we'll have to see.
Taj Mahal, you fill us with amazement. We all gaze with wonder on you.
One thing I still wasn't sure about is what exactly is the Taj Mahal Foxtrot?
The Taj Mahal Foxtrot was the title of a track that was recorded by African-American musicians playing at the Taj Mahal Hotel in the late 1930s. It's among the first jazz tunes located specifically in India, even lyrically at any rate, even if it doesn't have any melodic or harmonic flourishes. But I was fascinated by it because even though it was performed by African-American musicians, it was composed by a Bombay man. I thought this was among the first expressions of Indian jazz. But it's the title of my book, and I chose it because it really sort of represents this mishmash culture that Bombay is. And it really reflects something of Bombay's whimsies, I think.
Bombay Jazz was presented for the BBC World Service by me, Safraz Manzoor, and produced by Stephen Garner.